sky like a child's balloon. Committed Harry Carey while kneeling in a confessional at St. Dom's, confessing his self-murder to a dumbfounded young priest even as his guts accordioned out onto the bench like beef stew, performing an act of contrition in a fading, bemused voice as he lay in his blood and the steaming sausages of his intestines. But most vividly, over and over, he saw himself behind the wheel of the LTD, racing the engine a little in the closed garage, taking deep breaths and leafing through a copy of National Geographic, examining pictures of life in Tahiti and Auckland and the Mardi Gras in New Orleans, turning the pages ever more slowly until the sound of the engine faded to a faraway sweet hum and the green waters of the South Pacific inundated him in rocking warmth and took him down to a silver fathom.
December 19, 1973. It was 12:30 in the afternoon when he woke up and got out of bed. He felt as though he had been on a huge bender. His head ached monstrously. His bladder was cramped and full. There was a dead snake taste in his mouth. Walking made his heart thud like a snare drum. He was not even allowed the luxury of believing, for however short a time, that he had dreamed everything he remembered of the previous night, because the smell of gasoline seemed rubbed into his flesh, and it rose fulsomely fragrant from the pile of his clothes. The snow was over, the sky was clear, and the bright sunshine made his eyes beg for mercy. He went into the bathroom, sat on the ring, and a huge diarrhea movement rushed out of him like a mail train highballing through a deserted station. His waist fell into the water with a sickening series of jets and plops that made him groan and clutch his head. He urinated without getting up, the rich and dismaying smell of his digestion's unsavory end product rising thickly around him. He flushed and went downstairs on his orangewood legs, taking clean clothes with him. He would wait until the god-awful smell cleared out of the bathroom, and then he would shower, maybe all afternoon. He gobbled 3 Excedrin from the green bottle on the shelf over the kitchen sink, then washed them down with 2 big gulps of Pepto-Bismol. He put on hot water for coffee and smashed his favorite cup by fumbling it off its hook. He swept it up, put out another, dumped instant Maxwell House into it, and then went into the dining room. He turned on the radio and swept across the dial looking for news, which, like a cop, was never there when you needed it. Pop music. Feed and grain reports. A golden nugget 'cause you dug it. A call-in talk show. A swap shop program. Paul Harvey selling bankers' life insurance. More pop music. No news. The water for the coffee was boiling. He set the radio to one of the pop stations and brought his coffee back to the table and drank it black. There was an inclination to vomit with the first 2 mouthfuls, but after that it was better. The news came on, first national, then local. On the city news front, a fire was set at the site of the 784 Thruway Extension construction near Grand Street in the early hours of this morning. Police Lieutenant Henry King said that vandals apparently used gasoline bombs to fire a crane, 2 payloaders, 2 bulldozers, a pickup truck, and the on-site office of the Lane Construction Company, which was entirely gutted. An exultation as bitter and dark as the taste of his unsweetened coffee closed his throat at the words, "entirely gutted." Damage done to the payloaders and bulldozers was minor, according to Francis Lane, whose company got a substantial subcontracting bid on the crosstown extension. But the demolition crane values at $60,000 and is expected to be out of service for as long as 2 weeks. 2 weeks? Was that all? More serious, according to Lane, was the burning of the on-site office, which contained timesheets, work records, and 90% of the company's cost accounting records over the last 3 months. "This is going to be the very devil to straighten out," Lane said. "It may set us back a month or more." Maybe that was good news. Maybe an extra month of time made it all worthwhile. According to Lieutenant King, the vandals fled the construction site in a station wagon, possibly a late-model Chevrolet. He appealed for anyone who may have seen the car leaving the construction area by Heron Street to come forward. Francis Lane estimated total damage in the area of $100,000. In other local news, State Representative Muriel Reston again appealed for... He snapped it off. Now that he had heard, and had heard in daylight, things seemed a little better. It was possible to look at things rationally. Of course, the police didn't have to give out all their leads, but if they really were looking for a Chevy instead of a Ford, and if they were reduced to pleading for eyewitnesses to come forward, then maybe he was safe, at least for the time being. And if there had been an eyewitness, no amount of worrying would change that. He would throw away Mary's floor bucket and open the garage to air out the stink of gasoline, make up a story to explain the broken back window if anyone asked about it, and most important, he would try to prepare himself mentally for a visit from the police. As the last resident of Crest Allen Street West, it might be perfectly logical for them to at least check him out. And they wouldn't have to sniff up his back trail very far to find out he had been acting erratically. He had screwed up the plant. His wife had left him. A former co-worker had punched him out in a department store. And, of course, he had a station wagon, Chevrolet or not. All bad, but none of it proof. And if they did dig up proof, he supposed he would go to jail. But there were worse things than jail. Jail wasn't the end of the world. They would give him a job, feed him. He wouldn't have to worry about what was going to happen when the insurance money ran out. Sure, there were a lot of things worse than jail. Suicide, for instance. That was worse. He went upstairs and showered. Later that afternoon, he called Mary. Her mother answered and went to get Mary with a sniff. But when Mary herself answered, she sounded nearly gay.
Hi, Bart. Merry Christmas in advance.
No, Merry Christmas, he responded. It was an old joke that had graduated from humor to tradition.
Sure, she said. What is it, Bart?
Well, I've got a few presents, just little stuff, for you and the nieces and nephews. I wondered if we could get together somewhere. I'll give them to you. I didn't wrap the kids' presents.
I'd be glad to wrap them, but you shouldn't have. You're not working.
But I'm working on it, he said.
Bart, have you done anything about what we talked about?
The psychiatrist?
Yes.
I called two. One is booked up until almost June. The other guy is going to be in the Bahamas until the end of March. He said he could take me then.
What were their names?
Names? Gee, honey, I'd have to look them up again to tell you. Adams, I think the first guy was. Nicholas Adams.
Bart,
she said sadly. It might have been Aaron's, he said wildly.
Bart, she said again.
Okay, he said. Believe what you want. You will anyway.
Bart, if you'd only...
What about the presents? I called about the presents, not the goddamn shrink. She sighed.
Bring them over Friday, why don't you? I can...
What? So your mother and father can hire Charles Manson to meet me at the door? Let's just meet on neutral ground, okay?
They're not going to be here, she said. They're going to spend Christmas with Joanna.
Joanna was Joanna St. Clair, Jean Calloway's cousin, who lived in Minnesota. They had been close friends in their girlhood, back in that pleasant lull between the War of 1812 and the advent of the Confederacy, he sometimes thought. And Joanna had had a stroke in July. She was still trying to get over it, but Jean had told him and Mary that the doctor said she could go at any time. That must be nice, he thought, having a time bomb built right into your head like that. Hey, bomb, is it today? Please, not today. I haven't finished the new Victoria Holt.
Bart, are you there?
Yes, I was wool gathering.
Is 1 o'clock all right?
That's fine.
Was there anything else?
No, uh-uh.
Well?
Take good care, Mary.
I will. Bye, Bart.
Goodbye. They hung up, and he wandered into the kitchen to make himself a drink. The woman he had just talked to on the phone wasn't the same woman that had sat tearfully on the living room couch less than a month ago, pleading for some reason to help explain the tidal wave that had just swept grandly through her ordered life, destroying the work of 20 years and leaving only a few sticks poking out of the mudflats. It was amazing. He shook his head over it the way he would have shaken his head over the news that Jesus had come down from the sky and had taken Richard Nixon up to heaven upon wheels of fire. She has regained herself. More. She had regained a person he hardly knew at all. A girl woman he barely remembered. Like an archaeologist, she had excavated that person and the person was a little stiff in the joints from his long storage, but still perfectly usable. The joints would ease, and the new old person would be a whole woman, perhaps scarred by this upheaval, but not seriously hurt. He knew her perhaps better than she thought, and he had been able to tell, strictly from the tone of her voice, that she was moving ever closer to the idea of divorce, the idea of a clean break with the past, a break that would splint well and leave no trace of a limp. She was 38. Half of her life was ahead of her. There were no children to be casually maimed in the car wreck of this marriage. He would not suggest divorce, but if she did, he would agree. He envied her new person and her new beauty. And if she looked back 10 years from now on her marriage as a long, dark corridor leading into sunlight, he could feel sorry she felt that way, but he couldn't blame her. No, he couldn't blame her. December 21, 1973. He had given her the presents in Jean Calloway's ticking ormolu living room, and the conversation that followed had been stilted and awkward. He had never been in this room alone with her, and he kept feeling that they should neck. It was a rusty, knee-jerk reaction that made him feel like a bad double exposure of his college self. "Did you lighten your hair?" he asked.
"Just a shade,"
she shrugged a little. "It's nice. Makes you look younger."
"You're getting a little gray around the temples, Bart. Makes you look distinguished."
"Bullshit. It makes me look ratty." She laughed, a little too high-pitched, and looked at the presents on the little side table. He had wrapped the owl pen, had left the toys and the chess set for her to do. The dolls looked blankly at the ceiling, waiting for some little girl's hands to bring them to life. He looked at Mary. Their eyes caught seriously for a moment, and he thought irrevocable words were going to spill out of her, and he was frightened. Then the cuckoo jumped out of the clock, announced 1:30, and they both jumped and then laughed. The moment had passed. He got up so it wouldn't come around again. Saved by a cuckoo bird, he thought. That fits. "Got to go," he said.
"An appointment?"
"Job interview."
"Really?"
She looked glad.
"Where? Who? How much?"
He laughed and shook his head. "There's a dozen other applicants with as good a chance as me. I'll tell you when I get it."
"Conceited."
"Sure."
"Bart? What are you doing Christmas?"
She looked concerned and solemn, and it suddenly came to him that an invitation to Christmas dinner and not to some New Year's divorce court had been the thing on her lips inside.
God!
He almost sprayed laughter. "I'm going to eat at home."
"You can come here," she said. "It would be just the two of us."
"No," he said thoughtfully, and then more firmly. "No. Emotions have a way of getting out of hand during the holidays. Another time." She was nodding, also thoughtfully. "Will you be eating alone?" he asked.
"I can go to Bob and Janet's." "Really, are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Well..."
But she looked relieved. They walked to the door and shared a bloodless kiss. "I'll call you," he said.
"You better."
"And give my best to Bobby."
"I will."
He was halfway down the walk to the car when she called,
"Bart! Bart, wait a minute!"
He turned almost fearfully.
"I almost forgot," she said. "Wally Hamner called and invited us to his New Year's party. I accepted for both of us. But if you don't want to..."
"Wally?" He frowned. Walter Hamner was about their only crosstown friend. He worked for a local ad agency. "Doesn't he know we're, you know, separated?"
"He knows, but you know Walt. Things like that don't faze him much."
Indeed, they didn't. Just thinking about Walter made him smile. Walter, always threatening to quit advertising in favor of advanced trust design, composer of obscene limericks and even more obscene parodies of popular tunes, divorced twice and tagged hard both times. Now impotent, if you believed gossip, and in this case he thought the gossip was probably true. How long had it been since he had seen Walt? 4 months? 6? Too long. "That might be fun," he said, and then a thought struck him. She scanned it from his face in her old way and said,
There won't be any laundry people there.
He and Steve Ordner know each other.
Well, yes, him.
She shrugged to show how unlikely she thought it was that him would be there, and the shrug turned into an elbow-holding little shiver. It was only about 25 degrees.
Hey, go on in, he said. You'll freeze, dummy.
Do you want to go?
I don't know. I'll have to think about it.
He kissed her again, this time a little more firmly, and she kissed back. At a moment like this, he could regret everything. But the regret was far away. Clinical.
Merry Christmas, Bart, she said,
and he saw she was crying a little.
Next year will be better, he said, the phrase comforting, but without any root meaning. Go inside before you catch pneumonia.
She went in, and he drove away, still thinking about Wally Hamner's New Year's Eve party. He thought he would go. December 24, 1973. He found a small garage in Norton that would replace the broken back window for $90. When he asked the garage man if he would be working the day before Christmas, the garage man said, "Hell yes, I'll take it any way I can get it." He stopped on the way at a Norton U-Wash It and put his clothes in two machines. He automatically rotated the agitators to see what kind of shape the spring drives were in, and then loaded them carefully so each machine would extract, only in the laundromats they called it spin dry, without kicking off on the overload. He paused, smiling a little.
You can take the boy out of the laundry, Fred, but you can't take the laundry out of the boy. Right, Fred?
Fred?
Oh, fuck yourself.
That's a hell of a hole, the garage man said, peering at the spider-webbed glass.
Kid with the snowball, he said. Rock in the middle of it.
It was, he said. It really was. When the window was replaced, he drove back to the U-Wash It, put his clothes in the dryer, set it to medium hot, and put 30 cents in the slot. He sat down and picked up someone's discarded newspaper. The U-Washit's only other customer was a tired-looking young woman with wire-rimmed glasses and blonde streaks in her long reddish-brown hair. She had a small girl with her, and the small girl was throwing a tantrum.
I want my bottle!
God damn it, Rachel!
Bottle!
Daddy's going to spank you when we get home, the young woman promised grimly, and no treats before bed.
Bottle!
Now, why does a young girl like that want to streak her hair, he wondered, and looked at the paper. The headline said, Small Crowds in Bethlehem, Pilgrims Fear Holy Terror. On the bottom of page one, a short news story caught his eye, and he read it carefully. Winterberger says acts of vandalism will not be tolerated. Local. Victor Winterberger, Democratic candidate for the seat of the late Donald P. Nash, who was killed in a car crash last month, said yesterday that acts of vandalism such as the one that caused almost $100,000 worth of damage at the Route 784 construction site early last Wednesday cannot be tolerated in a civilized American city. Winterberger made his remarks at an American Legion dinner and received a standing ovation. We have seen what has happened in other cities, Winterberger said. The defaced buses and subway cars and buildings in New York, the broken windows and senselessly marred schools of Detroit and San Francisco, the abuse of public facilities, public museums, public galleries. We must not allow the greatest country in the world to be overrun with Huns and barbarians. Police were called to the Grand Street area of the construction when a number of fires and explosions were seen by... Continued page five. Column 2. He folded the paper and put it on top of a tattered pile of magazines. The washer hummed and hummed a low soporific sound. Huns. Barbarians. They were the Huns. They were the rippers and chewers and chompers, turning people out of their homes, kicking apart lives as a small boy might kick apart an anthill. The young woman dragged her daughter, still crying for a bottle, out of the U-Wash It. He closed his eyes and dozed off, waiting for his dryer to finish. A few minutes later, he snapped awake, thinking he heard fire bells. but it was only a Salvation Army Santa who had taken up his position on the corner out front. When he left the laundry with his basket of clothes, he threw all his pocket change into Santa's pot.
"God bless you," Santa said.
December 25, 1973. The telephone woke him around 10 in the morning. He fumbled the extension off the night table, put it to his ear, and an operator said crisply into his sleep,
"Will you accept a collect call from Olivia Brenner?"
He was lost and could only fumble.
"What? Who? I'm asleep."
A distant, slightly familiar voice said,
"Oh, for Christ's sake."
And he knew.
"Yes," he said. "I'll take it."
Had she hung up on him? He got up on one elbow to see.
"Olivia? You there?"
"Go ahead, please."
The operator overrode him, not willing to vary her psalm.
"Olivia, are you there?"
"I'm here."
The voice was crackling and distant.
"I'm glad you called."
"I didn't think you'd take the call."
"I just woke up. Are you there? In Las Vegas?"
"Yes,"
she said flatly. The word came out with curious, dull authority, like a plank dropped on a cement floor.
"Well, how is it? How are you doing?"
Her sigh was so bitter that it was almost a tearless sob.
"Not so good."
"No?"
"I met a guy my third night here. Went to a party and got so fucked up."
"Dope?" he asked cautiously, very aware that this was long distance and the government was everywhere.
"Dope?"
she echoed crossly.
"Of course it was dope. Bad shit. Full of decks or something. I think I got raped."
The last trailed off so badly that he had to ask, "What?"
"Raped!"
she screamed, so loudly that the receiver distorted.
"That's when some stupid jock playing Friday Night Hippie plays hide the salami with you while your brains are somewhere behind you, dripping off the wall. Rape? Do you know what rape is?"
"I know," he said.
"Bullshit, you know.
Do you need money?"
"Why ask me that? I can't fuck you over the telephone. I can't even hand job you."
"I have some money," he said. "I could send it, that's all. That's why."
Instinctively, he found himself speaking not soothingly, but softly, so she would have to slow down and listen.
"Yeah, yeah."
"Do you have an address?"
"General Delivery, that's my address."
"You don't have an apartment?"
"Yeah, me and this other sad sack have got a place. The mailboxes are all broken. Never mind. You keep the money. I've got a job. Screw, I think I'm going to quit and come back. Merry Christmas to me."
"What's the job?"
"Pushing hamburgers in this fast food joint. They got slots in the lobby, and people play them and eat hamburgers all night long. Can you believe it? The last thing you have to do when your shift is over is to wipe off all the handles of the slot machines. They get all covered with mustard and mayo and catsup. And you should see the people here. All of them are fat. They've either got tans or burns. And if they don't want to fuck you, you're just part of the furniture. I've had offers from both sexes. Thank God my roomie's about as sex-oriented as a juniper bush. Oh, Christ, why am I telling you all this? I don't even know why I called you. I'm going to hitch out of here at the end of the week when I get paid."
He heard himself say, "Give it a month."
"What?"
"Don't go chicken shit. If you leave now, you'll always wonder what you went out there for."
"Did you play football in high school?" "I bet you did."
"I wasn't even the water boy."
"Then you don't know anything, do you?"
"I'm thinking about killing myself."
"You don't even..." "What did you say?"
"I'm thinking about killing myself."
He said it calmly. He was no longer thinking about long distance and the people who might monitor long distance just for the fun of it. Ma Bell, the White House, the CIA, the FBI.
"I keep trying things, and they keep not working. It's because I'm a little too old for them to work, I think. Something went wrong a few years ago, and I knew it was a bad thing, but I didn't know it was bad for me. I thought it just happened, and then I was going to get over it. But things keep falling down inside me. I'm sick with it. I keep doing things."
"Have you got cancer?"
she whispered. I think I do.
You want to go to a hospital. Get...
It's soul cancer.
You're ego-tripping, man.
Maybe so, he said. It doesn't matter. One way or the other, things are set, and they'll turn out the way they will. Only one thing that bothers me, and that's a feeling I get from time to time that I'm a character in some bad writer's book, and he's already decided how things are going to turn out and why. It's easier to see things that way, even than to blame it on God. I mean, what did he ever do for me, one way or the other? No, it's this bad writer. It's his fault. He cut my son down by writing in a brain tumor. That was chapter one. Suicide or no suicide, that comes just before the epilogue. It's a stupid story.
Listen, she said, troubled. If they have one of those dial-help outfits in your town, maybe you ought to...
They couldn't do anything for me, he said. And it doesn't matter. I want to help you. For Christ's sake, look around out there before you go chicken shit. Get off dope. You said you were going to. The next time you look around, you'll be 40, and your options will mostly be gone.
No, I can't take this. Some other place...
All places are the same, unless your mind changes. There's no magic place to get your mind right. If you feel like shit, everything you see looks like shit. I know that. Newspaper headlines, even the signs I see, they all say, yeah, that's right, Georgie, pull the plug. This eats the bird.
Listen.
No, you listen. Dig your ears out. Getting old is like driving through snow that just gets deeper and deeper. When you finally get in over your hubcaps, you just spin and spin. That's life. There are no plows to come and dig you out. Your ship isn't going to come in, girl. There are no boats for nobody. You're never going to win a contest. There's no camera following you and people watching you struggle. This is it. All of it. Everything.
You don't know what it's like here, she cried.
No, but I know what it's like here.
You're not in charge of my life.
I'm going to send you $500. Olivia Brenner, care of General Delivery, Las Vegas.
I won't be here. They'll send it back.
They won't, because I'm not going to put on a return address.
Throw it away, then.
Use it to get a better job.
No.
Then use it for toilet paper, he said shortly, and hung up. His hands were shaking. The phone rang 5 minutes later. The operator said,
Will you accept?
No, he said, and hung up. The phone rang twice more that day, but it was not Olivia, either time. Around 2 p.m, Mary called him from Bob and Janet Preston's house. Bob and Janet, who always reminded him, like it or not, of Fred and Wilma Flintstone. How was he? Good. A lie. What was he doing for Christmas dinner? Going out to Old Custom House tonight for turkey with all the trimmings. A lie. Would he like to come over here instead? Janet had all kinds of leftovers and would be happy to get rid of some. No, he really wasn't very hungry at the minute. The truth. He was pretty well looped, and on the spur of the moment he told her he would come to Walter's party. She sounded pleased. Did he know it was BYOB? When did Wally Hamner have a party that wasn't, he asked, and she laughed. They hung up, and he went back to sit in front of the TV with a drink. The phone rang again around 7:30, and by that time he was nothing as polite as looped. He was pissy-assed drunk.
Hello? Dawes? Dawes here. Who's there? Magliori, Dawes. Sal Magliori.
He blinked and peered into his glass. He looked at the Zenith Color TV, where he had been watching a movie called Home for the Holidays. It was about a family that had gathered at their dying patriarch's house on Christmas Eve, and somebody was murdering them, one by one. Very Christmassy.
"Mr. Magliori," he said, pronouncing carefully. "Merry Christmas, sir. and the best of everything in the new year. Oh, if only you knew how I dread 74,
Magliori said dolefully.
That's the year the oil barons are going to take over the country, Doss. You see if they don't. Look at my sales sheet for December, if you don't believe me. I sold a 1971 Chevy Impala the other day. This car is clean as a whistle, and I sold it for $1,000. $1,000! Do you believe that? A 45% knockdown in 1 year. But I can sell all the 71 Vegas I can get my hands on for $1,500-$1,600. And what are they, I ask you?
Little cars? He asked cautiously.
They're fucking Maxwell House coffee cans, that's what they are, Magliori shouted. Saltine boxes on wheels. Every time you look at the goddamn things cross-eyed and say booga booga at them, the engine's out of tune or the exhaust system drops off or the steering linkage is gone. Pintos, Vegas, Gremlins, they're all the same. Little suicide boxes. So, I'm selling those as fast as I can get them. And I can't move a nice Chevy Impala unless I fucking give it away. And you say Happy New Year? Jesus, Mary, Joseph the Carpenter.
That's seasonal, he said.
I didn't call about that anyway, Magliori answered. I called to say congratulations.
Congratulations? He was honestly bewildered.
You know, crackle, crackle, boom, boom.
Oh, you mean shh, not on the phone. Be cool, Dawes.
Sure. Crackle, crackle, boom, boom. That's good, he cackled. It was you, wasn't it, Dawes?
To you, I wouldn't admit my middle name. Magliori roared.
That's good. You're good, Dawes. You're a fruitcake, but you're a clever fruitcake. I admire that.
Thanks, he said, and cleverly knocked back the rest of his drink.
I also wanted to tell you that everything was going ahead on schedule down there. Rumble and roar.
What? The glass he was holding fell from his fingers and rolled across the rug.
They've got seconds on all that stuff, Dawes. Thirds on most of it. They're paying cash until they got their bookwork straightened out, but everything is right on.
You're crazy.
No, I thought you ought to know. I told you, Dawes, some things you can't get rid of.
You're a bastard. You're lying. Why do you want to call a man up on Christmas night and tell him lies?
I ain't lying. It's your play again, Dawes. In this game, it's always gonna be your play.
I don't believe you.
You poor son of a bitch,
Magliori said. He sounded honestly sorry, and that was the worst part.
I don't think it's gonna be a very happy new year for you either.
He hung up. And that was Christmas. December 26, 1973. There was a letter from them in the mail. He had begun to see the anonymous people downtown that way, the personal pronoun in italics and printed in drippy, ominous letters like the printing on a horror movie poster, as if to confirm what Magliori had said. He held it in his hand, looking down at the crisp, white business envelope, his mind filled with almost all the bad emotions the human mind can feel. Despair, hatred, fear, anger, loss. He almost tore it into small pieces and threw it into the snow beside the house, and then knew he couldn't do that. He opened it, nearly tearing the envelope in half, and realized that what he felt most was cheated. He had been gypped. He had been rooked. He had destroyed their machines and their records, and they had just brought up a few replacements. It was like trying to fight the Chinese army single-handed. It's your play again, Dawes. In this game, it's always going to be your play. The other letters had been form jobs, sent from the office of the highway department. Dear friend, a big crane is going to come to your house sometime soon. Be on the lookout for this exciting event as we improve your city. This was from the city council, and it was personal. It said, December 20, 1973. Mr. Barton G. Dawes, 1241 Crestallen Street West, M.W. Dear Mr. Dawes, it has come to our attention that you are the last resident of Crestallen Street West who has not relocated. We trust that you are experiencing no undue problems in this matter. While we have a 19642-A form on file, Acknowledgement of Information Concerning City Roads Project 6983-426-73-74-HC, we do not yet have your relocation form, 6983-426-73-74-HC-9004, blue folder. As you know, we cannot begin processing your check of reimbursement without this form. According to our 1973 tax assessment, the property at 1241 Crestallen Street West has been valued at $63,500. And so we are sure that you must be as aware of the situation's urgency as we are. By law, you must relocate by January 20, 1974, the date that demolitions work is scheduled to begin on Crestallen Street West. We must also point out again that according to the State Statute of Eminent Domain, SL19452-36, you would be in violation of the law to remain in your present location past midnight of January 19, 1974. We are sure you understand this, but we are pointing it out once more so that the record will be clear. If you are having some problem with relocation, I hope you will call me during business hours, or better yet, stop by and discuss the situation. I am sure that things can be worked out. You will find us more than eager to cooperate in this matter. In the meantime, may I wish you a Merry Christmas and a most productive New Year? Sincerely, for the City Council, JTG/TK. No, he muttered. You may not wish it. You may not. He tore the letter to shreds and threw it in the wastebasket. That night, sitting in front of the Zenith TV, he found himself thinking about how he and Mary had found out, almost 42 months ago now, that God had decided to do a little road work on their son Charlie's brain. The doctor's name had been Younger. There was a string of letters after his name on the framed diplomas that hung on the warmly paneled walls of his inner office, but all he understood for sure was that Younger was a neurologist, a fast man with a good brain disease. He and Mary had gone to see him at Younger's request on a warm June afternoon, 19 days after Charlie had been admitted to Doctor's Hospital. He was a good-looking man, maybe halfway through his 40s, physically fit from a lot of golf played with no electric golf cart. He was tanned a deep Cordovan shade, and the doctor's hands fascinated him. They were huge hands, clumsy-looking, but they moved about his desk, now picking up a pen, now riffling through his appointment book, now playing idly across the surface of a silver-inlaid paperweight, with a lissom grace that was very nearly repulsive. "Your son has a brain tumor," he said. He spoke flatly, with little inflection, but his eyes watched them very carefully, as if he had just armed a temperamental explosive. "Tumor?" Mary said softly, blankly. "How bad is it?" he asked Younger. The symptoms had developed over the space of 8 months. First, the headaches. Infrequent at the beginning, then more common. Then, double vision that came and went, particularly after physical exercise. After that, most shameful to Charlie, some incidents of bedwetting. But they had not taken him to the family doctor until a terrifying temporary blindness in the left eye, which had gone as red as a sunset, obscuring Charlie's good blue. The family doctor had had him admitted for tests, and the other symptoms had followed that. Phantom smells of oranges and shaved pencils, occasional numbness in the left hand, occasional lapses into nonsense and childish obscenity. "It's bad," Younger said. "You must prepare yourself for the worst. It is inoperable." Inoperable. The word echoed up the years to him. He had never thought words had taste, but that one did. It tasted bad and yet juicy at the same time, like rotten hamburger cooked rare. Inoperable. Somewhere, Younger said, deep in Charlie's brain, was a collection of bad cells roughly the size of a walnut. If you had that collection of bad cells in front of you on the table, you could squash them with one hard hit, but they weren't on the table. They were deep in the meat of Charlie's mind, still smugly growing, filling him with random strangeness. One day, not long after his admission, he had been visiting his son on his lunch break. They had been talking about baseball, discussing, in fact, whether or not they would be able to go to the American League baseball playoffs if the city's team won. Charlie had said,
"I think if their pitching pitching staff holds up pitching..."
He had leaned forward. "What, Fred? I'm not tracking you." Charlie's eyes had rolled wildly outward.
"Fred?" George whispered. "Freddy!" "Goddamn motherfucking mother-sucking fuckhole!" his son screamed from the clean white hospital bed. "Cunt-licking, dick-rubbing, ass-wipe son of a whoring bitch!"
"Nurse!" he had screamed as Charlie passed out. "Oh, God, nurse!" It was the cells, you see, that had made him talk like that. A little bunch of bad cells no bigger, say, than your average-sized walnut. Once the night nurse said he had screamed the word boondoggle again and again for nearly 5 minutes. Just bad cells, you know. No bigger than your garden variety walnut. Making his son rave like an insane dock walloper. Making him wet the bed, giving him headaches, making him, during the first hot week of that July, lose all ability to move his left hand. "Look," Dr. Younger had told him on that bright, just-right-for-golf June day. He had unrolled a long scroll of paper, an ink tracing of their son's brainwaves. He produced a healthy brainwave as a comparison, but he didn't need it. He looked at what had been going on in his son's head and again felt that rotten yet juicy taste in his mouth. The paper showed an irregular series of spiky mountains and valleys, like a series of badly drawn daggers. Inoperable. You see, if that collection of bad cells, no bigger than a walnut, had decided to grow on the outside of Charlie's brain, minor surgery would have vacuumed it right up. No sweat, no strain, no pain on the brain, as they had said when they were boys. But instead, it had grown down deep inside and was growing larger every day. If they tried the knife, or laser, or cryosurgery, they would be left with a nice, healthy, breathing piece of meat. If they didn't try any of those things, soon they would be bundling their boy into a coffin. Dr. Younger said all these things in generalities, covering their lack of options in a soothing foam of technical language that would wear away soon enough. Mary kept shaking her head in gentle bewilderment, but he had understood everything exactly and completely. His first thought, bright and clear, never to be forgiven, was, "Thank God it's not me." Then the funny taste came back, and he began to grieve for his son. Today a walnut, tomorrow the world. The creeping unknown. The incredible dying son. What was there to understand? Charlie died in October. There were no dramatic dying words. He had been in a coma for 3 weeks. He sighed and went out to the kitchen and made himself a drink. Dark night pressed evenly on all the windows. The house was so empty now that Mary was gone. He kept stumbling over little pieces of himself everywhere. Snapshots, his old sweatsuit in an upstairs closet, an old pair of slippers under the bureau. It was bad, very bad, to keep doing that. He had never cried over Charlie after Charlie's death, not even at the funeral. Mary had cried a great deal, for weeks, it seemed. Mary had gone around with a perpetual case of pink eye, but in the end, she had been the one to heal. Charlie had left scars on her, that was undeniable. Outwardly, she had all the scars, Mary before and after. Before, she would not take a drink unless she considered it socially helpful to his future. She would take a weak screwdriver at a party and carry it around all night. A rum toddy before bed when she had a heavy chest cold, that was all. After, she had a cocktail with him in the late afternoon when he came home, and always a drink before bed. Not serious drinking by anyone's yardstick, not sick and puking in the bathroom drinking, but more than before. A little of that protective foam, undoubtedly just what the doctor would have ordered. Before, she rarely cried over little things. After, she cried over them often, always in private. If dinner was burned, if she had a flat. The time water got in the basement and the sump pump froze and the furnace shorted out. Before, she had been something of a folk music buff, white folk and blues. Van Ronk, Gary Davis, Tom Rush, Tom Paxton, Spider John Kerner. After, her interest just faded away. She sang her own blues and laments on some inner circuit. She had stopped talking about their taking a trip to England if he got promoted a step up. She started doing her hair at home, and the sight of her sitting in front of the TV in rollers became a common one. It was she their friends pitied, rightly so, he supposed. He wanted to pity himself, and did, but kept it a secret. She had been able to need and to use what was given to her because of her need, and eventually that had saved her. It had kept her from the awful contemplation that kept him awake so many nights after her bedtime drink had lulled her off to sleep. And as she slept, he contemplated the fact that in this world, a tiny collection of cells no bigger than a walnut could take a son's life and send him away forever. He had never hated her for healing, or for the deference other women gave her as a right. They looked on her the way a young oilman might look on an old vet, whose hand or back or cheek is shiny with puckered pink burn tissue, with the respect the never-hurt always hold for the once-hurt now healed. She had done her time in hell over Charlie, and these other women knew it, but she had come out. There had been before. There had been hell. There had been after. And there had even been after, when she had returned to two of her four social clubs, had taken up macrame. He had a belt she had done a year ago, a beautiful twisted rope creation with a heavy silver buckle monogrammed BGD. Had taken up afternoon TV, soap operas, and Merv Griffin chatting with the celebrities. Now what? He wondered, going back to the living room. After? It seemed so. A new woman, a whole woman, rising out of the old ashes that he had so crudely stirred. The old oil man with skin grafts over the burns, retaining the old savvy but gaining a new look. Beauty only skin deep? No. Beauty was in the eye of the beholder. It could go for miles. For him, the scars had all been inside. He had examined his hurts one by one on the long nights after Charlie's death, cataloging them with all the morbid fascination of a man studying his own bowel movements for signs of blood. He had wanted to watch Charlie play ball on a little league team. He had wanted to get report cards and rant over them. He wanted to tell him over and over to pick up his room. He wanted to worry about the girls Charlie saw, the friends he picked, the boys' internal weather. He wanted to see what his son became, and if they could still be in love as they had been until the bad cells, no bigger than a walnut, had come between them like some dark and rapacious woman. Mary had said, "He was yours." That was true. The two of them had fitted so well that names were ridiculous, even pronouns a little obscene. So they became George and Fred, a vaudeville sort of combination, two Mortimer Wiebelfiesers against the world. And if a collection of bad cells no bigger than a walnut could destroy all those things that are so personal that they can never be properly articulated, so personal you hardly dared admit their existence to yourself, what did that leave? How could you ever trust life again? How could you see it as anything more meaningful than a Saturday night demolition derby? All of it was inside him. but he had been honestly unaware that his thoughts were changing him so deeply, so irretrievably. And now it was all out in the open, like some obscene mess vomited onto a coffee table, reeking with stomach juice, filled with undigested lumps. And if the world was only a demo derby, wouldn't one be justified in stepping out of his car? But what after that? Life seemed only a preparation for hell. He saw that he had drained his drink in the kitchen. He had come into the living room with an empty glass. December 31, 1973. He was only two blocks from Wally Hamner's house when he put his hand into his overcoat pocket to see if he had any Canada mints in there. There were no mints, but he came up with a tiny square of aluminum foil that glinted dully in the station wagon's green dash lights. He spared it a puzzled, absent glance and was about to toss it into the ashtray when he remembered what it was. In his mind, Olivia's voice said, "Synthetic mescaline. Product 4, they call it. Very heavy stuff." He had forgotten all about it. He put the little foil packet back into his coat pocket and turned onto Walter's Street. Cars were lined up halfway down the block on both sides. That was Walter, all right. He had never been one to have anything so simple as a party when there might be a group grope in the offing. The principle of the pleasure push, Wally called it. He claimed that someday he would patent the idea and then publish instructional handbooks on how to use it. If you got enough people together, Wally Hamner maintained, you were forced into having a good time, pushed into it. Once, when Wally was expounding this theory in a bar, he had mentioned lynch mobs. "There," Walter had said blandly, "Bart has just proved my case." He wondered what Olivia was doing now. She hadn't tried to call back, although if she had, he would probably have weakened and taken the call. Maybe she had stayed in Vegas just long enough to get the money, and had then caught a bus for, where? Maine? Did anyone leave Las Vegas for Maine in the middle of winter? Surely not.
Product 4, they call it. Very heavy stuff.
He snuggled the wagon up to the curb behind a sporty red GTX with a black racing stripe and got out. New Year's Eve was clear but bitterly cold. A frigid rind of moon hung in the sky overhead like a child's paper cutout. Stars were spangled around it in lavish profusion. The mucus in his nose froze to a glaze that crackled when he flared his nostrils. His breath plumed out on the dark air. Three houses away from Walter's, he picked up the bass line from the stereo. They really had it cranked. There was something about Wally's parties, he reflected. Pleasure principle or no, the most well-intentioned of just-thought-we'd-drop-bys ended up staying and drinking until their heads were full of silver chimes that would turn to leaden church bells the next day. The most dyed-in-the-wool rock music haters ended up boogieing in the living room to the endless golden gassers that Wally trotted out when everybody got blind drunk enough to look back upon the late 50s and early 60s as the plateau of their lives. They drank and boogied, boogied and drank until they were panting like little yellow dogs on the 4th of July. There were more kisses in the kitchen by halves of differing holes, more feel-ups per square inch, more wallflowers jerked rudely out of the woodwork, more normally sober folk who would wake up on New Year's Day with groaning hangovers and horridly clear memories of prancing around with lampshades on their heads, or of finally deciding to tell the boss a few home truths. Wally seemed to inspire these things, not by any conscious effort, but just by being Wally. And, of course, there was no party like a New Year's Eve party. He found himself scanning the parked cars for Steve Ordner's bottle green Delta 88, but didn't see it anywhere. Closer to the house, the rest of the rock band coalesced around the persistent bass signature and Mick Jagger screaming. Every light in the house was blazing. Fuck the energy crisis. Except, of course, in the living room, where Rub Your Pee-Pees would be going on during the slow numbers. Even over the heavy drive of the amplified music, he could hear 100 voices raised in 50 different conversations, as if Babel had fallen only seconds ago. He thought that, had it been summer, or even fall, it would have been more fun to just stand outside, listening to the circus, charting its progress towards its zenith, and then its gradual fall-off. He had a sudden vision, startling, frightening, of himself standing on Wally Hamner's lawn and holding a roll of EEG graph paper in his hands, covered with the irregular spikes and dips of damaged mental function, the monitored record of a gigantic, tumored party brain. He shuddered a little and stuck his hands in his overcoat pockets to warm them. His right hand encountered the small foil packet again, and he took it out. Curious, he unfolded it, regardless of the cold that bit his fingertips with dull teeth. There was a small purple pill inside the foil, small enough to lie on the nail of his pinky finger without touching the edges. Much smaller than, say, a walnut. Could something as small as that make him clinically insane? Cause him to see things that weren't there, think in a way he had never thought? Could it, in short, mime all the conditions of his son's mortal illness? Casually, almost absently, he put the pill in his mouth. It had no taste. He swallowed it.
"Bart!" the woman screamed. "Bart Dawes!"
It was a woman in a black off-the-shoulder evening dress with a martini in one hand. She had dark hair, put up for the occasion, and held with a glittering rope spangled with imitation diamonds. He had walked in through the kitchen door. The kitchen was choked, clogged with people. It was only 8:30. The tidal effect hadn't gotten far yet then. The tidal effect was another part of Walter's theory. As a party continued, he contended, people would migrate to the four corners of the house. "The center does not hold," Wally said, blinking wisely. T.S. Eliot said that. Once, according to Wally, he had found a guy wandering around in the attic 18 hours after the party ended. The woman in the black dress kissed him warmly on the lips, her ample breasts pushing against his chest. Some of her martini fell on the floor between them.
"Hi," he said. "Who's you?"
"Tina Howard, Bart. Don't you remember the class trip?"
She wagged a long, spade-shaped fingernail under his nose.
"Naughty boy!"
"That, Tina? By God, you are!"
A stunned grin spread his mouth. That was another thing about Walter's parties. People from your past kept turning up like old photographs. Your best friend on the block 30 years ago, the girl you almost laid once in college, some guy you had worked with for a month on a summer job 18 years ago.
"Except I'm Tina Howard Wallace now," the woman in the black dress said. "My husband's around here somewhere."
She looked around vaguely, spilled some more of her drink, and swallowed the rest before it could get away from her.
"Isn't it awful? I seem to have lost him."
She looked at him warmly, speculatively, and Bart could barely believe that this woman had given him his first touch of female flesh, the sophomore class trip at Grover Cleveland High School, 109 years ago, rubbing her breast through her white cotton sailor blouse beside
Cutter Stream, he said aloud.
She blushed and giggled.
"You remember all right."
His eyes dropped in a perfect, involuntary reflex to the front of her dress, and she shrieked with laughter. He grinned that helpless grin again.
"I guess time goes by faster than we..."
"Bart!"
Wally Hamner yelled over the general party babble. "Hey, buddy! Really glad you could make it!" He cut across the room to them with the also-to-be-patented Walter Hamner party zigzag. A thin man, now mostly bald, wearing an impeccable 1962 vintage pinstriped shirt and horn-rimmed glasses. He shook Walter's outstretched hand, and Walter's grip was as hard as he remembered.
"I see you met Tina Wallace," Walter said.
"Hell, we go way back when," he said,
and smiled uncomfortably at Tina.
"Don't you tell my husband that, you naughty boy," Tina giggled. "Excuse, please. I'll see you later, Bart."
"Sure," he said.
She disappeared around a clump of people gathered by a table loaded with chips and dips and went on into the living room. He nodded after her and said,
"How do you pick them, Walter? That girl was my first feel. It's like this is your life."
Walter shrugged modestly.
"All a part of the pleasure push, Barton, my boy."
He nodded at the paper bag tucked under his arm. "What's in the plain brown wrapper?"
"Southern Comfort. You've got ginger ale, don't you?"
"Sure,"
Walter said, but grimaced.
Are you really going to drink that down by the Swanee River stuff? I always thought you were a Scotch man.
I was always a private comfort and ginger ale man. I have come out of the closet.
Walter grinned. Mary's around here someplace. She's kind of been keeping